Just after 1 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, the Fan, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you on a Thursday afternoon edition of Smith and Jones. And a lot coming up over the course of the next hour. We will get you teed up for the Thursday nighter. You just heard Andrew Nye mentioning the game that comes up tonight in the National Football League as we get set for Week 8 of the NFL with the Atlanta Falcons playing the Carolina Panthers. And we'll get into the discussion about some of the other storylines, some of the other games coming up this weekend as well. And in about 5-7 minutes time, we will speak with the former executive director of the NBA Players Association, the NBPA, and we will discuss, the season restart for the NBA and the fact that, Jonesy, it looks like the league is pushing for the December 22nd date, and now there is some pushback from the union side of things, from Michelle Robertson, from, the players that she represents, saying, hold on a second, we're not going to be doing anything too quick here and maybe missing on crossing some T's and dotting some I's and just kind of fast-tracking this. We want to make sure we're doing things properly when it comes to the negotiations, when it comes to the CBA, and obviously the cap that's coming. And on top of that, just proper rest and recuperation time for our players, given the flurry that they just finished less than a month ago, just a few weeks ago, and all of a sudden you want us back on the court in X amount of weeks. It looks like the association does not want to do that, and we'll maybe pick the brain of Charles Grantham when we talk to him in a few minutes' time.
I think it's going to be a balancing act, because the owners are going to say, all right, let's start on January 18th with, a 60-game season, and here's how much money that yields. You guys okay with that? Are you guys okay with less money? Because that's what's going to happen. I really think there's going to be some kind of balancing act here, Eric, because, if the games aren't played, or the quantity of games aren't played and the revenue isn't there. I mean, what did I hear yesterday? They lost, the NBA revenue was $8.3 billion, and that's down whatever percentage it was, 10, 12%, something like that, 8, 10, 12, somewhere in there. And that's a lot of math. That's a lot of money. And now you're going into it with the uncertainty still regarding fans. By the way, if you're going to try and get the calendar back on track for the 21-22 season, not this season, but the next season, you got to start earlier and end in time, by the way, so you guys can get your rest. So those are all the things that the owners are going to throw at them. And rightfully so, the players are saying, as I said, rightfully so, hey, man, we're the show. People don't come to watch you sit in your box. They come to watch us play. They come to watch the product on the floor. And we went through it, Eric, in the lockout season, back-to-back-to-back nights. Mm-hmm. And just recently, a few years ago, back-to-backs and 3 and 4 nights and 4 and 6 nights, back-to-back, day off, back-to-back, another day off. Like, it's tough. It's tough on a body. And I don't care that these guys are young and they're 24 and they're in great shape. It takes its toll on you. So I really think there's going to be a balancing act between both sides to come up with something.
The guys at Baseball Central have more on this coming up at the top of the hour, no doubt about it. But Jonesy, before we discuss more on the NBA and the negotiations, again, Charles Grantham, the former executive director of the NBPA, is going to join us, and we'll get into all that with Charles in a few minutes' time. And then a little bit later on, Bob Glauber, from Newsday, covers the National Football League, and we'll chat with him about Week 8 of the NFL season. But a few minutes here before we talk basketball and football on baseball and still the continued fallout from Justin Turner just a couple of nights ago. And I sat thinking about this last night, and I mean this quite seriously. If my wife, Jonesy, were to come down with a positive test for COVID-19, I wouldn't be kissing her. I'm going to take care of her. I'm going to make sure that she's taken care of. I'm going to wait on her hand and foot and probably isolate her in a room and knock on the door and leave the food and do all that stuff. I'm going to be a loving husband for her, but I'm not going to be interacting with her. I'm not going to be hanging out with her per se. I'm not going to be, certainly, as I said, kissing her. And if it was a good buddy of mine or something, if you and I are spending time on the road together, or if we're stuck at a sporting event together or whatever it may be, Let's rewind back to last June, Jonesy, and this was happening. If somehow the Raptors are winning the championship and you and I are working together and we've done everything we can to be as safe as possible and follow all the protocols, and then game 6 against the Warriors, we find out mid-broadcast that you've got COVID-19, man, I'm not hanging out with you, Jonesy. You know, I'm not passing off the trophy to you, high-fiving you, or hugging you, or embracing you. I'm not necessarily going to treat you like a pariah, but I'm going to say, hey, man, put a mask on and keep your distance at the very least. And I still am scratching my head at what Turner did, and even just the lack of real pushback from the Dodgers, in a sense. You know, when ownership comes out, well, you know, it's real hard to kind of keep him from this, and he's going to be a free agent, and this is like a potentially once-in-a-lifetime
garbage
type thing. You know, I get all that, but come on, that is garbage, right?
It's like telling the kid you're on punishment, and the kid says, what punishment? I'm going out. Go to your room. Go to my room? Forget it. I'm going out. And believe me, that happens these days. Believe me, it happens. And that's – Justin Turner was just obstinately, you know, defiant. That's it. Like, you know you have that, and you still go out there and selfishly put others at risk? I don't get it. Maybe it's a – I don't know. Maybe it's a generational. I don't get it. I know you won the World Series, but that's just the way. I never forget Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's words in the game where Magic played center and scored 42 points and they beat the Sixers, and he couldn't even travel because of a sprained ankle. And I'll never forget his words. Maybe it was his religious beliefs about, you know, kind of karma and that's the way things go. That's the way things work. That's the way it was meant to turn out. And he accepted that fully. And that didn't make the championship any less for him. He wasn't there. He couldn't celebrate. But, you know, he was still part of it. So I just think that, you know, and that's a mature, grown-up, philosophical attitude. And, you know, you see kids these days, oh, I got a big zit on my note, and I'm going out on the date with the prettiest guy or the prettiest girl. Hey, that's the way it goes. Like, you can't do anything about it. It happens. So, I mean, for Justin Turner and MLB not to have the bite, I think, to say no, like, there should be some kind of discipline meted out to the Dodgers, you know, the organization to him. I mean, yeah, I guess it's symptomatic of society and what's going on in the U.S. with all their cases going up. And if those are the prevailing attitudes, then that's what you're going to get.
Well, here's my other question, too, and I don't know if I've been given an answer on this yet or if it's out there, I haven't seen it or heard it yet as well. The reaction from some of the other players. When Turner is pulled from the game, do the players know that he was pulled because of COVID-19, or were they just told, like, because of their focus, he tweaked something, he had to come out, he's not feeling well, whatever it may be? Or did they know? Because how many of those guys then knew on the field that he was positive? I mean, I would hope that in the aftermath, once the game's actually over, that word might have gotten out, and as a teammate, as a brother, you're thinking, man, this is brutal. My guy Justin, he's in the back. I can't believe he's got it. Like, I am trying to celebrate the biggest moment of my career potentially, and maybe of my lifetime, certainly my professional life, but I'm still feeling for my friend, for my teammate, for my brother. But at the same time, then I see him come out. So do I know that he's sick as I'm embracing him and celebrating alongside with him, and I am willingly making that decision to embrace him and to continue on as if there is no problem and run the risk myself? Or was he guilty of not informing folks and then potentially infecting a bunch of people, you know, that had no idea? That's another element to this that I'm still not quite sure of. It's just, I don't know. I shake my head, Jonesy, because I know I would never do that to you. I wouldn't do that to a stranger. I wouldn't willingly go potentially infect a bunch of people. I wouldn't willing with anything, with any sickness, even if it's a common cold. I'm not walking around a store coughing and hacking and rubbing my hands all over or not covering my face, let alone something as serious as this. And I don't know what baseball can do other than, as you say, you know, some fines levied or whatever it may be. Because at the end of the day, what are you going to do? You're gonna suspend the guy 10 games next season, whoever he ends up playing for, because he came out on the field? I don't know what the punishment. I just think it's completely ignorant and irresponsible. And I don't even know if the league can or should do something. It's just on a human level. Forget as a baseball player, on a human level. Here we are a couple days removed, and I'm still just baffled by the thought process and the selfishness behind it.
I hear you. Society, it's what we face these days. It's what it is, and you know, we got to start doing a better job of looking after each other.
Well, I'll tell you who did a great job, and that was the NBA and its players. They certainly abided by the rules, kept it tight, kept it safe, and did the incredible. Perhaps some might say, Jonesy, the unthinkable, in keeping that bubble as safe as they did without a positive test in the 3+ months that they were down there. And full credit to the league, but certainly full credit to the Players Association as well, headed up by Michelle Roberts and Chris Paul. Maybe we can work in reverse then for this conversation, because there's a lot of stuff currently going on with the NBA and with the Players Association, but we can kind of go back a few months and discuss some of the other stuff that we've seen over the course of the summer and the bubble and the NBA's restart and everything else, as we bring into the conversation the former executive director of the NBPA, the Players Association, Charles Grantham. Charles, we appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always fun to join you guys.
Charles, how impressed were you by seeing what the league and what the players did, and the role, the massive role that the players played in agreeing to so many of the rules, so many of the sanctions, and to be leaving family and to be committing to months upon end to keep the league, keep themselves as safe as possible, but keep the league going and the business flourishing as well?
Well, firstly, you know, we're all in the business of maximizing revenue and minimizing costs, of course. But in this pandemic, science and, you know, the welfare of all of those, whether it be coaches, players, et cetera, take on a priority. So I was not surprised at the leadership provided by both Adam and Michelle. But I would say that we've always had, I believe, a very solid relationship between those who own teams or the commissioner's office and the players. And it speaks to that level of cooperation between the two that made this thing work. Who would have known that we could go into a bubble, which is, by the way, a major accomplishment by just operations. I mean, just operationally to make all that happen. So, and my hat's off to them, but I must say I expected nothing less.
Charles, so it's been a quick turnaround. Great to hear your voice, by the way, man. It really, really is. And I'm not sure when Eric and I get a chance to come down that way where you are, but you know, hopefully this thing passes at some point. We're talking about a really quick turnaround here.
Yes.
And
yes,
as you just mentioned, it's probably about maximizing revenue, minimizing costs, and there's going to have to be some kind of give and take with the season just ending and then turning it around for 72 games this year, having it end later than usual, and then trying to get back on a regular schedule for the 21-22 season. What do you think some of the key points will be? I mean, you've sat in that room across the table and you know, been through it all. What do you think some of the key points will be trying to get this thing ironed out? Because it sounds like some of the players aren't ready to turn it around that quickly.
Yeah. Well, this is from a negotiation standpoint. This is the traditional question of wants versus needs. You know, what do we want? I mean, ideally, optimally, the optimal mix would be to start on Christmas Day, et cetera, and have 5 games, et cetera. You know, my time, we would avoid Christmas Day, usually, because we wanted to give the players the chance to respect the Christmas holiday with their families. Now, that's changed over time, but it still goes back to wants versus needs. And, yes, we would like to get back to some form of normalcy, but by all indications, to me, right now, it looks like the virus is really going to control a lot of that, since we are looking here in the States as increased cases, a larger, a different challenge that was even presented at the bubble. So what I'm assuming things have to begin with certifying the losses. I mean, from a player's perspective, we have to be able to sit and tell the players that we have had our accounts, we've looked through all this, and we have certified that this is how much money has been lost. The next question will be, how do we absorb these losses over time? And is this the particular year that we will expect to absorb them all? Or, as business people, you take on certain risks to own the team, and we as employees may not be saddled with that same risk. whatever these losses are, you may have the opportunity to smooth them over time, whereas we, with young people who have 2-3-4 year careers and guaranteed contracts, is this a fact that they would therefore make monies available for those losses, or are we talking about deferred payments to some of those individuals who are on 5 or 6 year contracts? I mean, all these things have to be considered. I'm assuming, however, that again, these parties have worked very well together, that the wants and needs will be satisfied to some degree, but the quick turnaround is going to raise several questions here, and that is, what is the incentive for the players who are now thinking that I would like a longer period of time? What is the incentive for them to return early? I see some of the bargaining points that are being established. What is the salary cap? What is the what will be the luxury tax threshold? Is the escrow, and by the way, we all know that this year's escrow started out at 10%, but ultimately ended up at almost at 35%. Is that going to be the threshold? We also know that in the past, the executives, including the commissioner, were asked to take a 20% reduction. Well, 20% versus 35%, is that fair and equitable? Is that a standard within the confines of a negotiation that is fair to both sides? So these are some of the things that are going to be discussed. Are they resolvable? Absolutely. But I think we are neglecting to think about the difficulty that the bubble presented, but also what is the NCAA college football going through right now, what is the NFL going through, and what has just completed with regard to Major League Baseball. Because now we don't have a bubble. Each team is going to be in its own locale. I see that they're thinking about regionalized scheduling and things like that will be helpful. But the concern from my perspective, and I'm sure from their perspective, would be the safety of all the people that are going to be involved here. And so that to me says that perhaps a later start, things that you hear is January or Martin Luther King Day, et cetera, may provide a better chance that we are able to get some vaccine or something else that's going to come along that we could perhaps deal more effectively with the virus, because there'll be no fans. And so, again, we're looking at getting through what I consider a more difficult year ahead than one that we've just completed. But a lot of questions. I believe that the parties are up to compromising at some point, and I think it will certainly work out.
Speaking with Charles Grantham, the former executive director of the NBA Players Association. Charles, you just touched on a lot of this in your last answer, but I'm going to kind of maybe go a little bit further. It's October 29th. You still have to have an NBA draft. You still have to have a free agent period. And then if you're talking about a potential start of December 22nd, you would have to start training camp at least by December 1st, I would think, to give yourselves 3 weeks minimum.
Yes.
All that said then, Is it naive to think that the season would start on December 22nd and the more realistic date is Martin Luther King Day or even later? Because it seems like there is a lot happening in the league, or a lot that still needs to happen, let alone the very important negotiations and the points of negotiations that you just so eloquently brought up, and all the things that the league needs to tick off. It just doesn't seem like there's time to do all of this.
Well, someone had to put out the first offer, and that first offer really is coming from the broadcast partners. And, you know, again, when you start looking at the prospect of the negotiation from a player's perspective, management and the broadcast partners are closer in partnership than we are, than the players are. So, you know, you could look at it from the standpoint that the broadcast partners put their optimal date out there, which is December 22nd. It rhymes with, or certainly would fit with, those who own teams as well. But remember this, A, that we got a short period of time, but B, there's never been a value associated with the risk intake that the players are taking. And that is, the owners aren't taking that risk. The players are definitely taking this risk, particularly at a time when the pandemic and the virus is worsening. So these are things that must be considered, but someone, again, had to put the first thing out there on the table. What do I see? I think maybe they may have to, since the 29th or 30th, 31st, you may have to look at it a little more flexibility there, maybe another week, I'm not sure. But sometimes it takes these kind of parameters to make sure these negotiated points work out as well. So they'll be working, under the gun a little bit here. But again, I don't want us to forget that the science has to lead, and we have to be very much concerned about every level of activity and competition during this time. Why? The major reason is we have no clue as to what the long-term implications are of the virus. And too many young people, whether they're at the college level or the pro level now, could possibly suffer consequences later in their career.
The science is leading the way, Charles. I mean, we're all at the mercy of, a vaccine or, the virus slowing down or being contained. And yet the economy, from an NBA standpoint, still has to go forward. You Yes. talked about some of the negotiating points. When it gets to the bottom line, do you think that there can be something done around sharing a smaller pie and not having one side just come to loggerheads, not having one side feel like they're giving up too much in terms of, percentages of BRI and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, let me just say this about that. I believe that given the relationship that has been established, the partnership, the we versus the I, if you think about baseball when they had that negotiation earlier in the summer or the year, they collided because the players then perceived that those who owned teams were trying to gain an edge and an advantage during this pandemic time that under ordinary circumstances would not even be on the table. They wanted to get a salary cap, okay, at a time when, hey, look, guys, we have to deal with this outside force affecting our business here, and we have to work together as partners. So as long as that doesn't seep into the negotiations, then I think these things will be ironed out. But is there something there that owner or player trying to gain an edge and advantage during this particular time when it's certainly the confrontation here is minimal from that standpoint, because we got to work together to deal with something that will negatively impact our business. And so I think that overrides some of these features, and that's why I think ultimately it works out.
Speaking with Charles Grantham, former executive director of the NBPA. Charles, in your opinion, is there any way, and I would say this, I suppose, about the National Hockey League as well, given that they are the other indoor sport.
Yes, and I forgot to mention them. You see what they did? They extended their CBA.
Right. Is there any way that you think that hockey or basketball, for that matter, would consider, or would specifically the players even consider, doing a bubble for a season? And I mean, there would have to be breaks. There's no doubt. I can't imagine asking somebody to commit to being away from their family for 6 months. I don't know how they would work out the schedule, but is there any possible way, or would that be a non-starter in your opinion?
Well, I don't want to say anything is a non-starter. As a negotiator, I didn't want to say it's a non-starter. However, but we also have to recognize that one of the factors here from the NBA's perspective, that bubble cost them $180 million. So the cost of the bubble is also something else that must be considered. In addition to whether or not they can essentially be away from their families for an entire season, I mean, that could be difficult. What is or will be at some point, and again, we're such in such a period of uncertainty, are the teams in the respective cities going to operate in a bubble within the city? In other words, are you going to be in a bubble in your particular city? Those are all things that are up for discussion. I kind of doubt, since they are talking about being based in your home city, I kind of believe that they're going to look at protocols that are similar to what both football and baseball have just done, which then throws into question the virus and how it's going to potentially interrupt the season.
Charles, you talked about just some of the stuff is mind-blowing here, and to think about it, you talked about protocols operating within a bubble within your city and guidelines around that. Hey, you're talking to two guys that call games for a team that's the only team outside of the U.S., and there's an international border. And when all of that is at the table, there's another team that has to be considered that you have to cross the border. And they're not a bit player. I don't see Toronto as that outpost that, oh, well, don't worry about them. I see Toronto as a major, you know, it's a major North American market. It's a major player, the fan base. They've won a championship recently. I don't think Toronto can be pushed to the side. But, I mean, what kind of things come up when it comes to Toronto and all of this? I mean, we've heard the talk about, you know, relocating the team and all of this other stuff. But, I mean, where do you think Toronto fits in all of this when all of these negotiations are going on?
Well, now you've taken us into international politics, and clearly, Toronto's a major player. They're a former champion. They're a wonderful city, obviously a great NBA home city, fans, the whole deal. And the possibility or the thinking that perhaps they would have to be relocated. I mean, that's now we're talking about, again, going back to why the United States hasn't done a better job of dealing with this virus from the very beginning. Now we're into a whole different political football that everybody seems to be uncomfortable with. But that's a real critical issue that they're going to have to face there, because I think we would have difficulty in scheduling.
Charles, we appreciate your time and your insight today. We probably could have done the entire hour with you, but we'll let you go. Again, thanks for the expertise and the insight. Stay safe and healthy, and we'll hope to talk soon.
You too, guys. And when you come to New York, we are definitely going to have dinner when this thing.
We've been trying to get it in for 3 years. So, like, next time, it's top of the list, buddy.
Okay, my friend. Be safe.
Take care.
There is Charles Grantham, former executive director of the NBPA, the NBA Players Association, and certainly, Jonesy, a lot for the league to navigate through in the coming weeks, and it's why I think that there's no chance December 22nd ends up happening, at least if we're looking at mid to late January. It buys you at least another month, and I'll tell you, not only another month to negotiate and to hammer this thing out and figure out a schedule, but another month to see how the first 4-6 weeks of COVID through the winter goes and the holiday season. Because I'll tell you the other thing, we're still waiting here in Canada to see the impact of Canadian Thanksgiving a couple weeks ago, and if people distanced and followed the rules, et cetera, et cetera. And the numbers haven't been good the last week or so. I don't need to tell anybody about that. But again, today, numbers over 900, at least in Ontario. What's it going to be like in the United States when it's late November and American Thanksgiving has come and gone, Jonesy, and that holiday, by all accounts, is more important to many Americans than even Christmas, and then you're looking at starting the NBA season less than a month after American Thanksgiving? Or would you rather wait another month to see what it looks like by January and see the impact of the holiday season and whether Americans followed the rules and were doing things properly or not?
I shudder to think, E. I really do. Look at the case numbers now. And we're not even anywhere near Thanksgiving in the U.S. The traveling, and what bothers me is you can take this thing as seriously as you want, and they talk about COVID fatigue, where people aren't washing their hands as much and they aren't wearing masks all the time and stuff. And it's hard to stay diligent. It really is. And I would say myself, I got to remind myself, like, when this thing was in everybody's consciousness back in March and April, I'd get up from the table in my own house and put hand sanitizer on. I'd walk 20 steps having not touched anything and say, got to put more hand sanitizer on. Like it was right in the forefront of your consciousness. Now I come in and I did wash my hands, didn't I? Yeah. Okay. You know what? Let me go make sure and I'll wash them again. And the hand sanitizer in my pocket is almost empty. It's like, I'll fill it up later. Well, that stuff's not happening in March. And I just think some people, even the ones that are the most diligent, are suffering a little bit of the fatigue and the getting used to living with it. And if that's what those people are doing, imagine the people that didn't take it seriously at the beginning. They start looking at death rates and this stuff, and well, it's not really that bad, or they find excuses and justifications for not following the rules. And I just shudder to think what it's going to be like around U.S. Thanksgiving.
When we come back after the break, we shift our attention from the NBA to the National Football League as we get set for Week 8 in the NFL. And it goes tonight with kickoff just after 8 o'clock with the Atlanta Falcons and Carolina Panthers. We'll discuss that and much more when we continue on Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Back on Smith & Jones, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. I want to mention Leadoff is giving away $100 to McDonald's during every show. If you send in the best text and make their morning, you could win. It's as simple as that. Find out more details at sportsnet.ca/590. Week 8 of the National Football League goes this weekend, and it officially starts this evening with the Thursday nighter, the Falcons and Panthers. Not exactly world beaters right here, with Atlanta struggling to a 1-6 record to start the season. Carolina, though, has looked pretty impressive, although only 3-4, to be able to kind of tread water and stay where they are. Without Christian McCaffrey in the lineup, Teddy Bridgewater doing his job, and you know, folks like Robbie Anderson and DJ Moore certainly helping offensively on that side of things for the Panthers, again sitting at 3-4. But McCaffrey ultimately will not play tonight. He was potentially expected to return to the lineup, but now reports circulating, Jonesy, that McCaffrey will not play, and he will likely make his return in Week 9 against Kansas City. So again, at least one more week for Carolina without McCaffrey. To talk about that and a whole lot more, we bring into the conversation, and we appreciate his time, national NFL writer from Newsday, Bob Glauber. Bob, thanks for this today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bob, how much of an absence is Christian McCaffrey right now for this Panthers team, and how much of a difference will he ultimately make for them when he does make his return, hopefully by next week?
Yeah, this guy is one of the most dynamic players at his position in the NFL. You know, he runs the ball, catches passes, and turns short receptions into big gains. So it's a big loss for them, but I think that Matt Rhule, the head coach, and Teddy Bridgewater have done a really good job of, you know, adjusting to Christian McCaffrey's absence. This is a competitive team from week to week, and he's been out a number of weeks. So I think it speaks to good coaching, good quarterback play, and just smart, you know, football. And that's what it takes. You know, you're going to lose key players from time to time, and, you know, unless it's your quarterback, you're going to have to find ways to get over it. And I think the Panthers have done a pretty darn good job with a first-year coach and a quarterback who just got there, who has shown some good resourcefulness over this time that McCaffrey's been out.
Bob, I want to get to the other team in this. They fired Dan Quinn about, 15, 20 days ago. The Falcons and our producer, Matt Marchese, found this stat, and I am just blown away by it, that the Falcons have 3 losses when reaching a win probability of 98%+ in 2020. I mean, they are throwing games away. The rest of the NFL has 8 of these losses since 2016.
Oh my
goodness. And one of those includes Atlanta in the Super Bowl. Like, is that the coach? Like, they make a coaching change. Is like, how much of that was Dan Quinn? How much of that was the players? And like, I mean, that's an unbelievable stat, and they just continue to shoot themselves in the foot.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you really do have to trace that in large measure to coaching. Look, you know, the players, they got to execute it, but, you know, it's out of the coaches' minds that these game plans are formed and that you know, games are won and lost, especially in the fourth quarter. It is such a fourth quarter league that, you know, you have to point to coaching as that evidence of that. I mean, you know, okay, three games this year, and then the Super Bowl was only a couple of years ago, so same coach was in that, except for last week, because, you know, last week was its own nightmare. But, I mean, it's absolutely coaching, and, you know, decisions in the fourth quarter are critical, and execution is as well. But, you know, I point to coaching, and then that's a major reason why Dan Quinn is not there anymore.
Speaking with Bob Glauber, national NFL writer for Newsday. Again, the game goes tonight between the Panthers and Falcons. That starts week 8 in the National Football League kickoff around 8:20 this evening. Bob, let's look ahead to the weekend and the games coming up on Sunday. And there are a few that we could, you know, circle and kind of point at specifically, but I think a lot of people are going to be tuned in to the Steelers and Ravens, as Pittsburgh, the lone remaining undefeated team at 6-0, and the Ravens coming in at 5-1. What do you make of the Steelers so far, and am I guilty of not giving them enough credit for being 6-0, but I still look at this team and I think, all right, they're good, but are they great? Are we talking about a legit Super Bowl contender right now in the Pittsburgh Steelers, Bob?
You know, I don't think yet, and that, you know, at an unbeaten, they're the only unbeaten, and, I mean, you got to give them credit for that. And Ben Roethlisberger has had a really dynamic season. Last week he did scuffle a little bit throwing the three picks, but I think have to give this team a lot of credit. I still think they're a notch below, say, a Kansas City. I just think Kansas City is just such a terrific team, and they did have that one loss, but I think they'll be, you know, there at the end, like a 14-2, 13-3 type season. But Pittsburgh, I really am not shocked. I'm shocked they're unbeaten this far in, but I did kind of look at them as one of those teams that, hey, don't be surprised if. You know, situations, because Roethlisberger coming back, and that was the big if, and, you know, if his elbow is going to recover from shoulder surgery, arm surgery at age, 38. So it's, you know, that's the time when quarterbacks do start to lose it, and very, very often, you know, you look at Joe Montana, Phil Sims, Dan Marino, Steve Young, a bunch of quarterbacks, it's age 38 when they just say, okay, that's it. They either go really fall off a cliff or just get hurt and can't play anymore. So Roethlisberger is fighting time a little bit, but he has done a very, very good job. So that's the key. He has recovered, and he has played very well. And I think the defense, maybe with the exception of what happened against Tennessee late last week, has been remarkable. It's, you know, I call them Steel Curtain 2.0. It's not your overpowering defense that, you know, was the great defense of the dynasty in the 70s, but it's a really fast, active defense. T.J. Watt, as good as there is as a pass rusher, and the linebacking crew, it's, you know, it's what you expect from a Steelers team in this day and age. So, I give them full credit. That said, I do think Baltimore is going to win the game and make this, more of a race. You know, Baltimore's right in there, and you know, they've had their issues. I saw a stat, I couldn't believe it. They have the fewest passing yards, I think, of any team in the league this year, which is really a testament to really good coaching, because they're doing it differently. But, you know, this is a blood rivalry, and it just, everything points to the Steelers losing just a little bit of momentum because they're playing a team that has been, you know, so familiar to them and such a bitter rival over the years.
Bob, you mentioned Kansas City, who is, I mean, everybody's clear favorite, and I hope we're not guilty of, you know, as in the words of the late Denny Green, crowning them before, you know, if you want to go ahead and crown them. I mean, Pittsburgh's undefeated. Mm-hmm. Baltimore's loss was to Kansas City, and there's a school of thought that says, all right, you lost to them in the regular season. We'll put that in our back pocket come playoff time. Are these the two most worthy? And it pains me to say this because my team, the Browns, are in that division, but and Eric's a Bills guy. But are those the two most worthy challengers, Pittsburgh and Baltimore, to Kansas City in the AFC?
Yes, I would say so. And you know, Buffalo, look, I think Buffalo will get better. It's just kind of weird how They started out so well, and they're just falling back a little bit. They have not been impressive, but they're winning, and I think they're a well coached team. Josh Allen, you know, has his limitations, but I do think you're right in that, you know, Baltimore and Pittsburgh being closest to Kansas City as far as, you know, contending teams. Now, look, it's the NFL. A lot changes. You know, people get hurt. Things happen. And reality changes from week to week and month, certainly month to month in the NFL. And I think we got a long way to go between now and January. We'll see what playoff positioning happens. But I think they would be the two most logical teams to be close enough to Kansas City to give them a game in a playoff situation.
Speaking with Bob Glauber from Newsday, national NFL writer. Bob, another interesting game certainly to look at. The San Francisco 49ers coming in at 4-3 against the Seahawks 5-1. Now, of course, Seattle this past week blew a lead, a 10-point lead with less than 3 minutes left. And, you know, full credit to Arizona for coming back and tying that game and then winning it in overtime. But what do you make of the Niners this year? And I know they've been banged up. I know they've had a lot of injuries. I'm still not sold. I don't know if I was sold even as a backup, but I'm certainly not sold as a starter on Jimmy Garoppolo. But at the same time, you know, you look at the resume and what he's done in his career. Does he get credit for you know, being in Super Bowls and making appearances and having a winning record through all these injuries right now? Or where do we see San Francisco going, and do we give them any hope this weekend against that high-octane offense of the Seahawks?
Yeah, I think this is really an intriguing matchup for those reasons. And, you know, first, Garoppolo, he's not an elite quarterback. I think we've seen enough of a sample size to make that determination. But, you know, he's really good. And he's really good within a system that Kyle Shanahan runs that is very quarterback-friendly. And like if Jimmy Garoppolo was playing in another city, you know, in New York with the Jets or even Giants or just, a crap team, he'd be bad. But he's got good things going on around him. He's got very good offensive line play. He's got very good running game. And he's got good to decent receivers. And he's a good play-action quarterback. But, you know, he's not Joe Montana. He's not Tom Brady. And, you know, who is? But he's good enough to get you there. He was maybe good enough to win that game last year in the Super Bowl. I'm thinking of one just overthrown pass where he had his receiver just going in for a touchdown that might have been the difference against Kansas City. Didn't happen, and the rest is history. But, you know, this team is pretty resilient. I think they righted themselves. They had a lot of injuries early on, but they're getting healthy, and that win against New England was you know, kind of a statement. I know New England's damaged, but, you know, they went in there and tore them apart. So now comes a real test against Seattle, which, you know, finally kind of met their match with Arizona. I think, you know, it exposed the problem that Seattle has, and that is it's not Russell Wilson, obviously, it's defense. And they have a problem on defense. They cannot rush the passer. It's why they traded for Carlos Dunlap with the Cincinnati yesterday. And that has to change, and that has to get better over time. Jamal Adams is hurt. I know he's a safety, but, you know, he did have a couple of sacks, and they were using him to rush the passer. So if he can come back in a couple of weeks, get Dunlop going a little bit, he's not the player he used to be, but, you know, he is a presence. They really miss guys like Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill. Remember those speed guys that really did tremendous work during their Super Bowl years? They miss that. And, you know, quarterbacks are just sitting back and throwing against them, and You can't live like that, and Seattle finally got burned by it.
Bob, Eric said, off the top that tonight's game is not really a world beater, but football's a channel stopper, and people will watch, and they're going to watch tonight, and Sunday night at 8:00, even though both teams have, you know, the combined four more wins than me, you, and Eric coaching teams, Philadelphia will play Dallas. And it will be the feature game on Sunday Night Football, and people will watch.
Oh, yeah.
What the heck is going on with that division? Is Philly going to win it with seven wins or something for the season? Or, I mean, it's a train wreck right now. It really, really is. What's going to happen in Dallas, and who's going to win that division?
Yeah. I mean, I think Philadelphia, you got to believe that they're the favorite right now to win it, kind of by just by process of elimination, really. Dallas is down to their third quarterback. The Giants are scuffling. They really lost a bad one in Philadelphia. I would have given them at least a puncher's chance had they not blown that lead down there. But they're still stuck at one win. In Washington, you know, Kyle Allen's their quarterback, and, you know, it's a good story. Ron Rivera, I love that he's back. You know, he finished his final cancer treatment the other day. That's heartwarming stuff. I think as a football team, though, they're very limited. So I think Philadelphia would be the team to beat. And if they get seven wins, that'd be a minor miracle because they'd be 7-8-1. And that tie with Cincinnati is going to really come into play late in the season when they have to determine, you know, who wins that division. I got an email from NBC promoting this game yesterday. It was so funny in my inbox. The tease was first place Philadelphia to host second place Dallas on Sunday night.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh man, that is putting lipstick on a pig, isn't it?
Bob, listen, we appreciate the time today. Enjoy the game tonight. Enjoy the action this weekend, and we'll talk again soon. All the best.
All right, sounds great. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thanks,
there is
Bob.
Bob Glauber, national NFL writer for Newsday. Jonesy, I got a crazy story for you, and it has nothing to do with sports, but I have to mention it anyway. So when we come back, I'm going to tell you about a dude that just walked himself into nearly $250,000 over a beverage. I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you about it next.
Okay, get to break so we got time. Hurry, hurry.
It's Smith and Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Jones with you. All right, Jonesy, so here's the deal. It's a class action lawsuit, so technically it involves you and I and anybody else that's ever had a can or a bottle of ginger ale, Canada Dry ginger ale. A man out in BC launched a class action lawsuit against Canada Dry and its owners and ended up winning and settling in court for $200,000 because he said that he bought and drank ginger ale for medicinal purposes and for herbal remedy reasons because they claimed, Canada Dry, that their ginger ale is made with real ginger and that ginger should have made him healthy and helped with nausea and everything else. So he ended up winning $200,000, but we're not going to get a piece of it because the money's going to be donated. How about that, though?
Then I know there's a whole bunch of you, especially at our traveling party with the Raptors, that are going to sue alcohol companies.
For what, man? Come on.
I'd be getting a sore throat on the plane and you'd be sitting beside me going, Jonesy, before there were drugs, there was alcohol, you know, have a shot of wine. That'll fix you.
Shot of rye, a shot of anything. I go have one right now, Jonesy. All right, back tomorrow at 1 o'clock with more Smith and Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.